I've always been infatuated with the idea of developing a game, especially an RPG. Taking all the great things from games you love, giving it your spin, and creating a unique experience for others to enjoy. Sounds easy, right? Well, maybe not so much. So in today's episode of my brand new podcast called Turn-Based, I'm excited to sit down with Josh Halloran from Critical Games, based right here in Australia, the developer of 8-Bit Adventures 1 and 2, to get an inside scoop on what it means to make an RPG and the ups and downs of doing so, and what's next for him and his studio. If you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe and comment down below. If you're listening to the program on one of the podcast apps, don't forget to leave a rating and follow the program. It really helps the show be seen and heard by other people. Let's get to the interview.
I'm super stoked that you're here, Joshua. It's a real pleasure to chat to you. I've been a fan of your stuff for a while. I've been following along with your game dev stuff, and I'm interested to learn a little bit more about what goes on behind the scenes and all that. So before we get into that, how are you going? It's honestly, it's like I said, it's a real pleasure to have you here today.
Oh, thank you very much. Doing good. Just very, very busy with a lot of currently secret projects. Not too much. But I mean, you know, just, yeah, lot going on. So it's good.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing. I did get the non-disclosure agreement you sent me beforehand. So thank you for that. So if there's anything we need to censor here, you just let me know.
if there's one thing you learn pretty quickly in the indie game scene, there are not many non-disclosure agreements. Everyone just kind of, you know, trust everyone to be quiet. So.
Yes, no, that's good. I'm sure there is a significant amount of trust. And to help, I suppose, to help build trust here for our audience, specifically for a bonus for the Australian people who will be listening or watching, let's settle a great debate. Coles or Woolies?
Ooh. Well, I mean, where I grew up, we always had Coles about 5 minutes away.
Yeah.
So, in terms of like giant conglomerate supermarket chains that are ripping us all off, that's my choice.
Never been a better time to feed your family for under $10. Supposedly.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That's funny. So obviously you're based in Australia. I'm based in Australia. So it's a very rare opportunity for me to be able to actually have a nighttime call with somebody.
Me too.
So it kind of feels like we're playing on the home team today, which is great. Just as we jumped on the call here, you took notice of my background, which is now cut out here because I've had to shift the camera angles. You pointed out the Chrono Trigger campfire scene that I have in my background. Is that one of your favorites of all time? Like, what's your favorite RPG, JRPG? I'd love to get some insight into...
Chrono. Yeah, Chrono.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that's the one that I take most influence from in pretty much every game that I develop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, okay, because Chrono Trigger never came out in Australia, it never came out in Europe that I'm aware of until, like, the PS1
era. DS, actually.
The DS was the...
Yeah, so PS1, in America, there was Final Fantasy Chronicles,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And that had Chrono Trigger.
Mm-hmm.
But in sort of the PAL territories, you actually only got Final Fantasy 4 and 5 on that disc.
Really?
So there's two different versions of the same sort of compilation.
I never knew that.
Yeah, so I've got it on a shelf over there.
Very interesting, because that was my first exposure with Chrono Trigger, and then Final Fantasy 4, but I... never picked it up at the time. I think my brain wasn't fully developed, so I didn't understand games with depth.
Yeah, I was pretty much the same. So.
Oh, that's funny. So would you say that like that Super Nintendo era is probably your favorite era then, like the 16-bit?
It's funny, actually, because probably I'm more PS1 to some degree. You know, because I'm 30, so I sort of grew up in that sort of, you know, sort of 32, 64-bit era. But my cousin, but you know, he'd grown up with sort of the 8 and 16-bit eras, so he introduced me to, you know, Final Fantasy 1 through 6 and Chrono Trigger and Mario RPG and all these different games at a very early age. So I sort of felt like I got, you know, 3 or 4 generations all at once when I was a kid, which was, I think that really helped my love of RPGs because there was just so much to choose from and so much to experience and, yeah.
You know, the PAL territories were a little bit lucky because I don't know if you're a fan of this specific title I'm about to name drop here, but
this one here, Terranigma. I've got a US repro cart, but did you
still never played it. Really? I've still never played it. Yeah, unfortunately.
Give it a shot, man. It's a really great game, and for a PAL only title, well, it came out in Japan as well, but
yeah.
PAL exclusive. It's a great game, and you might find some you get something out of it playing. It's pretty cool.
I've played Illusion of Gaia.
Yep.
Or Illusion of Time, as it was
part of the trilogy. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. But I've always wanted to actually get like a Terranigma, a repro or an original cartridge or something like that, but I've never found it for a reasonable price. So
I don't think retro games and reasonable prices don't coexist anymore.
That era is past. No, I got like a Link to the Past boxed from America for $30 Australian.
Wow.
And I want to say 2009.
Oh, that's about
something
right.
Like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Nowadays, no. Maybe triple that.
At least, yeah. So eBay is scary now, especially with Australian dollars.
Oh, tell me about it. I actually had to get out of retro game collecting recently, just because with the way that things are going, and like we mentioned with price gouging with supermarkets, it's either like, do I buy complete box Terranigma or groceries for my family? I don't know. It's a tough one. But yeah, look, it's great to speak with somebody who's a very like-minded JRPG enthusiast. I mean, for the few messages that I've sent back and forth, it's really cool. It's a treat to talk to you today. So you're part of Critical Games, and your most recent, which is your biggest title, is 8-Bit Adventures, which is awesome. And I actually found out about you through my friend Super Derek, which I'm drinking his mug right now. I saw a picture that he posted. It was of your game being played on a tiny little like CRT. I don't know if it was like a Sony PVM or something like that. And I was like, that looks great. What is that? And of course, I followed you on Twitter, and here we are. But this whole game development journey is, I suppose, a lifelong journey. What exactly got you into deciding, you know what, I'm going to do this, I want to do this, whether it's full-time, whether it's hobby, whatever. What made you get into this?
It's a good question. It pretty much goes back to about when I was 5 or 6. So it really has been a lifelong passion for me. It was games like Ocarina of Time that sort of redefined the way I thought about entertainment and what games were, and just that idea of like, okay, games can tell stories, games can replicate these massive worlds for me to explore. There was just something very novel that I didn't get from any other experience. You sort of felt like you were a co-author of the experience in video games, whereas a novel or something, you're getting a story essentially told to you. Whereas Ocarina of Time, I mean, I made so much fun for myself and just sort of imagining things going on in the world. It was a wonderful experience as a kid. So really, I sort of, from then on, I just decided like, this is what I want to do. And slowly but surely figured out how to do it. I eventually found programs online like Game Maker and RPG Maker. Just sort of gradually built up the skills by fiddling with those types of projects, and a lot of experimentation and a lot of drive to make games.
Mm. Is this something you went to university for at all? Because I know in Australia, it's funny because game dev is something you can study,
mm-hmm.
but I feel like it's only now just kind of coming into the cool, like it's cool to do that, or it's more accessible now.
Definitely. Yeah, no, it was 2011 when I went to college, and it was a private like college that was really expensive. I ended up dropping out after the first trimester, partly because I realized how expensive it was going to be.
Yep.
Because it was really already adding up. Then just as well, I didn't feel like I was learning a lot from it. Like one of our lessons was just, we went to an arcade and played arcade games, and that was it. And it's like, well, that cost me $500. it felt like with the work that I'd already been doing sort of as a kid and a teenager, just trying to sort of learn different systems and learn about how games are made. I sort of decided like, no, I'm going to sort of go back to that and try and push on myself and try and teach myself these skills, which I don't recommend anyone do. It's not an easy thing to do. I was definitely very full of myself, maybe at that age, about like, yeah, I can do all this sort of thing. And so I had to, you know, get humble and have a few failures and learn from those mistakes and that. But, you know, I got a lot better at game making and I did find my way. And I feel like I've got a pretty good handle on the job now.
It's funny you say that, because I actually think that's the best way to learn is just get straight into it. Make a resume for yourself, whether you're going into any business ventures.
That's true. Let alone anything else. Hands-on is great. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And especially with game developing, it's a bit difficult because it is a harder career choice to kind of build up to, because you need to have those failures. And then you have your whole audience stuff, which we'll get into later on in the program. But what were the kind of resources that you would look into? I mean, I suppose 2011, I mean, there was things accessible and there were a lot of hobbyists at that time. And I suppose the term indie dev had a bit of a stigma to it back then, I suppose. But there was a lot of people doing game developing and creating things. And it's always been there. But I suppose the term indie dev has more of a welcome. It's more welcoming because it's like, there's just one guy doing it, more or less. And he's probably learned just like you in this instance. But what were the kind of tools and stuff that you found access to? Was it like a lot of YouTube, a lot of forums? Like, how do you learn this on your own?
It was definitely a lot of forums, because that was still a little more, you know, in vogue, in 2011. But I mean, yeah, it's funny to think back, because I feel like a lot of it I really just kind of muddled my way through. You know, like, you would find YouTube tutorials or forum posts about like certain issues, but there weren't really a whole lot of like, okay, day one, you do this, day two, you do this. You know, there's all kinds of tutorials now, which I think is really good. A lot of them are very good at getting people started and hopefully teaching, you know, some good habits. It was a bit different back then. It was definitely a lot more sort of just experiment. And, you know, one of the best ways that I found to actually learn was to look at games that I enjoyed and was passionate about. So for me, that meant, you know, I looked at basically every RPG I could get my hands on and learned, okay, well, you know, how did they approach pacing, or how did they approach, like, the way cutscenes are framed, and, you know, like, when we make the pixel character move over here, like, what is that saying and why do they do that at that exact moment? And sort of, like, you know, I gradually picked up that, okay, it was actually very theatrical, the way that they sort of told stories, and then the way that they balanced combat, you know, how they figured out all that sort of thing. So it was really just a lot of analyzing the games that I'd been playing for years and loving for a long time, and trying to sort of build up my knowledge based on, you know, what experts had done in the past.
Yeah, I suppose... I hate to use this term. I want to put a pin in that thought, but I want to understand more of what your role is now at Critical Games. Like, what exactly do you do? Because if you look at the credits on 8-Bit Adventures, if you start the game, it's you and a couple of other people as well. So what exactly is your role right now? What's the extent of what you're doing?
It's actually kind of hard to answer, because, you know, if you say artist, then that's someone that makes, you know, makes the graphics or whatever, you know, it's easy to understand. But when it's, you know, what my role is encompasses just all kinds of things, really. So I design the game from day one. So I come up with what it's about and design the game, you know, gameplay, battle system, all that type of thing in as granular detail as I possibly can, pen and paper. Obviously, I manage the team. So anyone else that's working on a project, I'm sort of giving tasks to them and saying what needs to be done when. But then it's like, you know, in engine, I'll be building the levels, I'll be, setting up all the events to take place, choreographing cutscenes, writing the dialogue, you know, implementing the battle system elements, balancing the battle system, just all sorts of different tasks. So I guess you could say that my job is to put the game together after sort of initially designing it and, you know, getting the contributions from other people, like artists and composers and, a systems programmer or something like that.
So to give you the title of, like, creative director, is that kind of like a loose...
That's a good one, I think, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So back to the original thing there of when you started. I suppose that makes sense because when you are at that point where you're just starting by yourself in whether it's your bedroom or wherever else, you have to understand everything on such a small molecular level. So that way, when you do get to the point where you manage a team, you understand again what everybody's role is, and that's everybody can turn to you and have you be the final say of something like that. When you started, what kind of programs were available, and is there anything different to now? I suppose it's, I mean, I know there's different, there's a lot to video game development that I don't understand, so I apologize, but I know that there's a lot of engines that you can take advantage of now that maybe weren't as accessible back when you started 10 or so more years ago.
Well, it's funny, actually, because really it's all the same stuff, more or less. Like, like Unreal Engine was Unreal Engine 3 instead of Unreal Engine 5.
Yeah.
Unity was, well, it was owned by a different company for one thing, but it was, you know, obviously in a very different space. You know, I mean, I think GameMaker was trying to get sort of more professional focus a little bit at the time. You know, there was all sorts of, really just all sorts of programs like there are now. I think you've sort of seen maybe some of them find a direction a bit more and sort of decide like, okay, we're going to go for this and this is what we're going to be used for. And obviously Unreal Engine has become a much more ubiquitous engine in the industry, like all around for all kinds of games. But yeah, no, things really haven't actually changed that much in the engine space. It really is a lot of the same names.
Okay.
But I mean, I... Look, this is the thing. It's like I was using, in 2011, I was using RPG Maker XP.
I was going to ask that,
Yep. And I was using a program called Game Salad.
Okay.
Which was a sort of mobile game toolkit, which, you know, it had a lot of limitations, but it also had a lot of, it streamlined a lot of processes. So sort of, you know, since I was working as a one-man band at the time, completely, then that was a really handy you know, type of program to have and do some experiments on mobile.
Yeah, I suppose the thing is like when you're just starting out, you want to figure out how everything works, but then once you start to build on that foundation, you actually want to get some sort of finished product so that you can then use that to refine. what was like the first thing that you created? Obviously it's probably something that's not available to public now, but like what described to me like the first ever completed thing that you had was.
So it is technically available out there somewhere. I think it is. But no, it was an RPG called Path of Thanatos.
Yep.
It was released in late 2011 on a website called Amaranth Games.
Yep.
And they used to basically be like a specialist, like indie RPG website. So they were also a RPG developer and all that. But it was a... probably about 5 to 6 hour RPG, and it had a lot of like choice stuff going on. So I was really inspired by Dragon Age at the time.
Yeah.
So it had a lot of sort of things that you'd make decisions, and the story would splinter in different directions. And you know, good ending, bad ending, all that type of thing.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Well, you know what?
I did get some very kind reviews at the time, so that gave me confidence.
The good phrase is good and done is better than not done at all. And I suppose when you're starting out, you really need to, like you said initially, have those failures, have those setbacks, and then build on them. When you are looking at making a game, whether it's 8-Bit Adventures 2 or something else, what's your creative process? I mean, because I suppose... essentially, the game has to work on paper, right? Like, the story has to make sense. The ideas have to make sense. So, in theory, it should work on this one dimensional sheet of paper, and then you can easily translate from there. Is that pretty
With RPGs, definitely. Because, you know, when you're designing, like, a turn-based RPG battle system, you know, there has to be that sort of on-paper logic, which just makes sense. And, you know, you could follow, essentially, what a battle would be on paper. You know, this character uses this attack, it deals X amount of damage, it inflicts this status ailment. You know, it's all stuff that you can really sort of follow on paper. But just in general, you're right, because I think, you know, one of the things that I gradually learned was the importance of planning. And, you know, having that sort of, you know, not rigid plan, but a detailed plan so that you knew where you were going, and sort of how these systems would fare long term, rather than just sort of coming up with an idea and thinking, oh yeah, that sounds right. Because sometimes, you know, you create something and it's fine at the start of the game, and by the end of the game, it's completely broken or completely useless, or, you know, there's all these different things to take into account. And with 8-Bit Adventures 2, that was the biggest game I've ever made, you know, sort of like a 30 to 40 hour RPG. So there's a lot to take into account over that time, because, you know, obviously you start with like one character, and then by the end of the game, you've got seven characters, and you've got, you know, nearly, I think it was 70, 80 augments to equip, and you've got all these accessories and, you know, 100 abilities. It's all these things to try and keep under control, and that all does begin with, you know, planning at the start. And it's the same with the story as well.
Sure. So you have to have a clear end, like the finish in mind, knowing, yes, like, okay, this is what I'm starting with, this is where we're going to end. And I suppose you kind of fill in the gaps as you go to some extent, but you always, yes, have to have, yeah, that, like, we can't stray too far from this, otherwise it's going to be pretty muddy.
You can stray too far. You've just got to understand that you're adding months of time onto development every time you stray. For and sure. You've got to kind of make the determination of, like, okay, is this actually worth that extra time or not?
Yeah.
You know, 8-Bit Adventures 2 took 7 years. And so the important part about having that plan to start with was that, you know, a lot of this stuff I wouldn't be getting to for years in terms of, like, actual, you know, content creation. So it was important to sort of have everything planned out to a degree, so that then by the time that I, you know, I was still on target the whole time, even though it was over such a long period of time, even though ideas changed and developed, I still sort of knew where I was aiming for and, you know, what had to lead from one step to the next.
Sure. So at what point in your game development journey did Critical Games come into fruition? Was that, like, that was your studio name from the beginning, and then you just started creating things from there, or were you just doing stuff under your own name, under, like, releasing things individually as you went on different sites?
One of the mistakes that you can easily make as an indie developer is thinking of, like, you know, the fact that you're an individual, that can sort of seem like a weakness, like, oh, I'm not professional enough, or, you know, that type of thing. So I, yeah, Critical Games was just the name that I came up with, essentially, for my sole trader business. Mm-hmm. Just to, you know, sort of put out there, because I didn't want to put out, you know, my own name, because, well, I'm, you know, I'm a nobody. So I wanted to try and sound more professional. And it was only later on that I sort of learned that actually the individual aspect is really beneficial, because people like the fact that, you know, if you're an indie developer, they can actually treat you as a person and not as a business. So yeah, I sort of turned that around in the end, and I think I probably you know, the names of the people that have worked on the game now probably show up more than the Critical Games moniker.
I totally agree with that. Whether it's game development or content creation or whatever else, I think it's important to put yourself out there a little bit more, and it's a lot more difficult to have, like, believable confidence at first, because a lot, yeah, of times, like, you're not even sure if this is going to work out or not. So, you know, I'm very, very happy to have, you know, Joshua Halloran from Critical Games, the face of Critical Games, dare we say. But I mean,
I am Critical Games. Yeah,
you are Critical Games. I mean, it probably says on your ABN, I'm sure.
It does. Yeah. Technically, I am Joshua Halloran trading as Critical Games. Yeah.
That's funny. So 8-Bit Adventures comes out. What year was that? Was 20?
There's actually an interesting story about this. So technically, 8-Bit Adventures 1 original version comes out in 2013.
Yeah.
January 2013. But no one has played that version, and it's no longer available.
So what's the one on Steam right now?
So that is basically, I made this game. I made 8-Bit Adventures 1 original version entirely, well, initially entirely by myself. The composer ended up coming along, and thank goodness he did, because I'm terrible at making music. But on that original version, I did all the graphics and everything, and, you know, it was really just like me trying to do as much as possible all by myself. And it wasn't a good idea. It looked very ugly, and it was just not a very good game. People really, like, didn't like that when it released. So I sort of put it aside and thought, oh, well, you know, never mind. But then later on, someone, yeah, a person from a Greenlight Bundle Company reached out, and they wanted to put Ape Adventures on Steam. And of course, I was really embarrassed about having a bad product and people not liking it. So I said, I'll give me some time and I'll remaster it and fix it and try and make it better. And so that ended up being the version which is now on Steam and which people really liked, and sort of gave me the confidence boost to do more and really sort of take an ambitious step with the sequel.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is 31st of March 2015, so not far off from a 9-year anniversary almost, which first for the Steam release, which is great. Now I made the mistake of starting 8-Bit Adventures 2 before 1, and I need to go and play 1 because
I don't think that's a mistake.
I think it's fair, but I also understood because I was doing some more research here, and there's the three heroes, so that makes sense. But I gotta say, a lot of your, and I'm sorry, I'm gonna be jumping around here a lot because while I'm on the topic, but 8-Bit Adventures 1, very positive, 75 all reviews on Steam. That's great. So that was pretty much the point where you as a developer or Critical Games as a thing started to grow because you brought on somebody else for this, right? You started to scale from there?
Well, I mean, really, so for the remastered version, which is on Steam, we had Sebastian Cruz, the composer, and we had Jaram Fahi, who's the artist. In that version, he only did the character sprites.
Okay.
But because that was all I could afford from him at the time. But, that was the three of us, which carried over to the sequel. And then there was also Sufyan Noor. So he came on as programmer. And then that was the team for the sequels. So we went from three to four, but two of the four were doing a lot more than on the last game.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So I just think that's super interesting. It's funny because where you are right now is probably where you would have dreamt to have been maybe 10 years ago.
Definitely.
And I find that people aren't really aware of their place at the moment, because where you are right now, you might be having a bad day, but it's like, oh, actually, this is where I wanted to be. This is where I wanted to be doing. And I am equipped to take on these challenges. Describe to me, over, I suppose, at least in the infancy stages of Critical Games, when you're bringing on other people to help out, what was probably the most difficult thing initially with something like 8-Bit Adventures, the remaster for Steam or any other projects that you did before we get to 8-Bit Adventures 2?
Well, I mean, really, it just always came down to money.
Yeah.
That's the issue, right? If you've got sort of no funding, no backing, and you can't throw a lot of money at a project, it's very hard to get anywhere. I started to use royalty-free assets, which, so not like, Unity asset store stuff that you see now, but more like, there's a website called Open Game Art, and there's always been sort of open source artwork that artists provide for game developers. I sort of started trying to take some of that stuff and tried to work it into, just enhance sort of my own poor quality graphics.
Yeah.
And then sort of work, considering the budget that I did have, it was really just about, okay, what can we do with this budget? What should we prioritize? So I decided to prioritize character sprites for the 8-Bit Adventures 1 remaster, because obviously that's something that's on screen all the time. It's, one of the more expressive aspects of the game. Yes. So, things like that, really. It was just about sort of thinking about how to adapt the budget. While at the same time, I also still had a lot to learn about game development in general. And, I think that definitely shows in that first game. There's a few areas where I sort of think, I'd do that a bit differently now.
Well, I suppose that shows growth. And that's a great thing. Yeah. And that shows that, you're if you're cringing at something you did a few years ago, you're kind of on the right path because you can refine that thing. I suppose it could, because I'm really interested in it. Talk to me about budgeting and stuff. Is this something that became a very difficult thing on the risk of or on the edge of burnout, maybe? Because I know some people who are just solo devs or whatever, doing anything by themselves, even just down to business. Is it something that you teeter on the edge of burnout because you're just funding it all yourself?
It's yeah, I mean, I'm very, very fortunate because I'm currently living with my parents.
Yep.
And that takes a lot of financial burden off.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Because, yeah, what I decided with 8-Bit Adventures 2 was that, like, I needed to have, like, the most sincere crack at doing this as I possibly can. And game development is such a lengthy process, and there's so much to conceive of. So I really just wanted to sort of make it my focus, and thankfully so far that's paying off. But yeah, it was definitely a gamble to make. But even then, certainly trying to make the money cover everything that was needed. It's very hard to conceptualize just how much will actually be needed, because you write down, all right, I'll have a port town, and it'll have sort of this many NPCs, and these events will play out here and all that sort of thing. And obviously that's a lot of assets, so you've actually got to break that down into thinking, what do we need for this town, what's it going to look like, how can we sort of be economical about it.
Yes.
There's a lot to consider in everything really that you do, and that's one of the things that I'm being really mindful of in the projects that I'm working on now. Really just trying to think about, like, okay, I have the knowledge now to sort of conceptualize this stuff better. I know what things cost and what they require, so trying to sort of get that right from day one. Whereas for 8-Bit Adventures 2, my original projections were, probably 50% of what it ended up actually costing. So
yeah, well, I mean, look, I think that's great, and that's something that I want to try and humanize about people that I bring on this particular program, is that, like, there's a lot of what you see, like what you perceive online, like, here's this amazing game, here's this amazing mm-hmm. product that somebody's putting out, but at the same time, like, you are there working your behind off, living with your parents, which I'm totally behind that 100%, because you believe in that, and that's awesome, and this is something that people should go out and support, because and this is my next segue here. So you've already done 8-Bit Adventures 1 in this timeline. How do you take on, like, feedback, like in reviews and all that stuff? How do you compartmentalize that and then get on to creating your next big thing, which was 8-Bit Adventures 2? And I suppose we can talk a little bit about, I mean, the other stuff that we have on, that we can see on your Steam profile as well. Like, how do you take on all that feedback and just double down for the second one?
It was kind of a new experience, because I'd never made anything that sort of deserved a sequel, right? So it was sort of an interesting thing. I had some really diehard fans shortly after the first game had come out, so I did talk to them all and sort of get a sense of, what they liked about the first game, and I tried to take that on board and apply that in my planning. But you're right, it is hard, because a lot of people will say, do this or do that, but it's sort of like the bare bones of an idea. It's not really something fully formed. They're not having a concept of, like, oh, well, if you do this, then it affects all these other things and, changes the game in that way. So it was, I guess, trying to figure out what was the relevant idea, I guess, to the type of game I was making, and trying to take that on board as much as possible. There was good advice, particularly in regards to sort of combat and people wanting more customization and sort of more characters and more control over those characters. So, but not sort of like, necessarily like a full-on job system or something like that, where it was full customization. A lot of people sort of liked that characters had roles, but they just wanted to be able to play with those roles a bit more.
That's cool. That shows there's a lot of, I suppose, old school, an old school approach to it as well, which is really great. I mean, from what I played of 8-Bit Event, I need to go back and finish it. But there's a lot of stuff that you can do in that game, and that shows that, like, you've taken that feedback from the players, and it has influenced development. And so because you're a smaller dev, you can probably read every review. You can watch it.
I do.
Yeah.
And some of them hurt.
I know. This is what happens when you're putting yourself out there, or you're putting your games out there. You have to develop a the ability to read a combat that might hurt and not let it phase you, but just kind of internalize that and be like, okay, this is what they meant. They didn't mean to hurt. They didn't mean to hurt my feelings.
Exactly. It's,
you know, I get that all the time on YouTube comments. Like, no, I don't have a comb over. Yeah. I have a full head of hair. Thank you very much. You know who
you
are.
That's a rough one.
But I think that's great being open to feedback and open to letting the players feel like they have a say. I wouldn't necessarily say that's rare, but I just say you're aware of your audience and you want to continue making things specifically for them because it is such a niche thing.
Yeah. I mean, people, you know, people always do really appreciate when the developer is actually present. Like, I've had so many people say, like, oh, I've never sort of written anything and had the developer respond before. So they're really sort of surprised when I do, which is, I think it's just a nice, it's just nice. I mean, for me, it's nice for them. It creates a sense of community and bond and, you know, it is good marketing, like in the sense that like making connections with people that like your work, like they're going to then, you know, share your work with other people and things like that. It's funny how closed off we are as an industry in general. Like, we're not very transparent. We don't tend to actually respond to, you know, a lot of comments a lot of the time, certainly bigger companies.
Oh, for sure.
But, you know, in my experience, it's like, it's the best thing you can possibly do because word of mouth and people having people that actually want to support you because you are listening to them and you are trying to do your best. I think that's a really good connection.
So funny because I had your name on my notes on my Mac. I had Critical Games and I was like, oh, now that I'm doing this thing, I'm sending a message. I didn't expect to get a reply and I didn't expect for you to be so keen about it too. And that's wonderful. And I highly encourage anybody who's listening, go buy these games on Steam. I'll leave links wherever.
They're actually on sale right now as well.
They are. Yes, they are. That's 20-30% off.
30%.
But if you can buy them at full price support, I suppose in the kind of fake timeline we've made here, so you start making 8-bit adventures 2 in like 2017 ish
2015 actually.
So that's when you had more of an idea of what you wanted to do. So you obviously wanted to scale up quite a bit. Because, I mean, you're going from 8-Bit Adventures 1 was about 5 to 10 hours, 8 to 10 hours, roughly?
I'd say sort of more like 10 to 12 in that sort of range, based on what I've seen. I think you can definitely do it in sort of about 7 or 8 if you beeline it.
Yeah. So you're pretty much tripling the length or and then some of that game. I know we spoke a little bit about creative direction, but like, how do you do that? I mean, it's such a big, vague question, but like,
the answer is, you are an idiot that doesn't actually understand how you know, big the scale of the game that you're designing is quite yet.
Yeah.
Because you know, my thought was like, okay, it's basically like it's double the number of areas. You know, it's sort of double, like everything's basically been doubled. So this will be sort of a good like 20 to 25 hour kind of game, right? I didn't take into account that like, okay, we're going for a much higher fidelity than last time. We have a lot more nuance in the areas. They're sort of built out to a much greater level of detail. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of narrative requirements for sort of one-off areas and things like that. I didn't really appreciate just how much I had, you know, put in the plan at the time. So it was a bit of a wake-up call, because I mean, originally the idea was to do the game in 2 years. So 2 years turned into 7, which shows you you know, somewhat how far my projections were off, because you know, I'd really just been making games in a very, very rapid fire, you know, slightly haphazard way up until that point. And so this was where I sort of started applying a much higher level of polish, you know, because we had, you know, we had an artist doing every single visual element. So the fidelity was much higher, but that also took time. And, you know, there were so many things to consider compared to 8-Bit Adventures 1. Yeah.
Okay. In terms of developing a game,
when, I suppose this might be advice for people who are listening that want to get into game development or are in game development, but they don't know how to reach out to other people. Where do you find the people that you work with? Is it something like looking on Fiverr or like Skillshare or something like that? Or is there Discord groups or like, I'm sure it's all of the above, but like,
yeah. Yeah, it's hard, to be honest, like, to find the exact type of person you're looking for. Like, finding someone that, like, can do, like, little 8-bit characters.
It's very specific.
Yeah, it is very specific, and, you know, not everyone necessarily has that skill set, because even though it seems really simple on the surface, sort of getting that style right actually is very much, you know, an aesthetic in itself. Sure. You know, the people, I mean, the composer that I work with and continue to, you know, I've worked with him since 2012 and continue to work with him. You know, we met on a forum. He just put up a post basically saying like, hey, I'm a composer. I'd love to work on someone's game. So we met that way. With, Jerome, the artist on 8-Bit Adventures 2, I found his, DeviantArt, portfolio. I really liked his stuff, and so I reached out, and it turned out he was in Australia, so that was a really nice coincidence.
Yeah.
Yeah, the programmer for 8-Bit Adventures 2, I met him on the RPG Maker forums, actually.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, but I mean, nowadays, I do actually find a lot of people on Discord.
Yep.
There's a wonderful, for any RPG developers out there, or people who just, you know, are interested in indie JRPG development, I highly recommend the Something Classic Discord server.
Yeah.
So they're the developers that made Shadows of Adam, they're making Quartet right now. But basically every sort of like indie RPG developer more or less is on there. There's a lot of artists on there, there's composers, there's all sorts of people, and they all know their stuff really well. That's another place which I've met a lot of people on there.
So you're at the point now where you'd say you have a good network of people that you could call on if you need something from somebody.
Yeah, yeah. And it gets kind of gone both ways, because I've been doing some work on a couple of other people's RPGs, actually.
That's great.
That's
really good. I got to say, because we're talking about like graphics and stuff at the moment for just 8-Bit Adventures 2, it is, I wrote down, because I booted it up on my OLED Steam Deck today, the OLED Steam Deck.
Oh, nice.
It is the best Game Boy Color JRPG ever. It is gorgeous. It's amazing, like the fluidity to the movements on screen, to the battle system, like all everything. It's a great looking game.
I mean all credit to Jerome for that, because he knocked it out of the park.
Gorgeous.
We're basically just talking about like, okay, we want to do what Shovel Knight did for sort of 8-bit platformers. We want to sort of do that for like 8-bit RPGs.
The first thing that came to my mind when I was, because I just to remind myself, playing it this morning, Shovel Knight. And I think that's a great thing. I was actually going to ask you if Shovel Knight was kind of an influence, because I feel like when Shovel Knight came out, I feel like it kind of turned a lot of heads with what people were doing. Like looking back at that specific style, that faux 16-bit kind of stuff, because it is, but it isn't.
It's basically so what they do, and it's what we do as
please
well.
Please tell me.
It's basically what it is. It's actually drawn at 16x16 pixels, so it is technically 8-bit art.
Yes,
but the NES had a hard limit on how many colors you could show at once, and Shovel Knight and 8-Bit Adventures 2 both throw that limit out the window. And we just display as many colors as we want at the same time. But we are using the NES color palette. We're just basically using an NES that is more powerful than what it actually was.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, all right. Yeah, so obviously you wouldn't be able to put it on cartridge. But if you could, I would buy the first one. I'd be in line.
It'd look amazing, wouldn't it?
I would love to do that. I gotta
your point of Game Boy Color is actually really astute, because Game Boy Color could essentially display more colors at once.
Yep.
To my understanding anyway, than the NES could. That's, so you got that really vibrant look.
That's exactly why I said it. Because like a lot of the color palette in that reminded me of Mario Tennis. Just like games like that were just really vibrant back in the day.
They had to be, because the screen had no backlight.
Yep.
And so they were trying to make it as vibrant as possible so it would stand out.
Yep. Yeah, well, I'm glad that comment or compliment isn't lost on you, because that's exactly what I thought playing this morning.
That's very high praise. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, look, that's my era. So it's like any time that comes up, I love those games.
Yeah. So, okay, you've 8-Bit Adventures 2 took you a considerable amount of time. And the first time I ever heard about what you did was, I think, just before release last year, 2023, because this came out February 1st. I saw this and I saw the trailer and I was like, oh my God, this is cool. Like, this, I'm the target market for this. And like everybody else who's watching and listening, this is the target market for this. And this is why I wanted to highlight your games and you and what you do. It's a freaking masterpiece, dude. It's awesome. And it's so great that it's a smaller team, smaller developer. And it's even better that it's Australian. Since I live here, I like to try and support the locals, you know. Love your local.
Yeah, thank you very much. I have masterpieces about as high as
that's awesome.
So,
well,
yeah, thank you.
I mean, you got 176 very positive Steam reviews. I mean, for a smaller team, that's a big number.
It is, yeah. I've been really happy so far. And, you know, it is hard to get people to actually review your games. So mm-hmm. I've been very, very touched by how many people have sort of, you know, written to me just to sort of say, oh, you know, I took the time to review your game, hope it helps.
Yeah,
that type of thing. And yeah,
I went through and read a bunch of them this morning, and there's not one bad one. The only con that I could find, you know,
yeah
but you know what I mean, like it's over. There's the overarching, yeah, this is great. What's some of the most memorable things you've had, whether it's in development of 8-Bit Adventures 2 or maybe just a little bit after that? I'm sure you get a rush of doing promo and stuff, and I want to ask some more questions about that. But like, what's something memorable about this experience that you've had with 8-Bit Adventures 2?
Gosh, there's a lot. I mean, certainly like all the reviews you get and all the comments you get, that is really special. Because, you know, there have been people that have talked about, like, just, you know, how the game's emotionally connected with them, how attached they've gotten to certain characters and things like that. That's, you know, that's really special. You know, just having your work actually touch someone and reach someone in some way. You know, people have talked about how much they've loved the battle system, or it's hearing awesome. People, the fact that they've, you know, some people have played it, like, you know, 2 or 3 times now, which is very, very flattering. But just, you know, I guess from thinking back to development, one memorable thing was when I released the first look demo, which was in 2017. So this was really, really early.
Yes, that's right. And that's still on Steam, I think.
No, we've got an updated demo, I think.
Oh, a free demo. Okay.
Yeah, I hope so, anyway.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a lot more to the demo now. It was in a very early state. We literally got the demo finished an hour before it was scheduled to go live.
Oh, my God.
On the first look demo, which was, yeah, it was intense.
Yeah, I bet.
But, you know, like, people had really, really good feedback from that, and it was stuff that I was sort of reticent to agree with at first, but it made the game better. Things just like having a sprint button. You know, I sort of thought, like, oh, well, you know, it's sort of designed, at the time we were using random battles, and so I was thinking, like, oh, it's sort of designed for, you know, to work off based on how many steps you do and that sort of thing. I don't want random battles appearing more quickly, but, you know, the more I thought about it, it's like, no, people are right. Like, this is saying, a lot of people are saying it's a fair point, so I changed that around, and that in turn ended up meaning that I changed the random encounter system to a on-map enemy system, and that was a good change, definitely, so... I definitely think about like people's advice and sort of the process of learning to listen. The other really memorable experience was Gamescom 2020.
Okay, yeah.
Because that was obviously during the pandemic.
Yes.
And obviously every event was cancelled, so Gamescom was doing online only. But because of that, I got in for I think it was just a very cheap price compared to what they normally do.
Sure.
So I figured I'd have a go. IGN was going to do this live stream for all the games that were involved in Gamescom 2020, and so I put all this effort into making this, you know, fancy trailer and all that sort of thing, and then it didn't actually get put in the live stream.
Oh my gosh!
Because they basically covered it up in the Excel tab, like one of the columns was sort of too squished over, and it hid my trailer's link.
Oh man.
But the woman that was dealing with me from IGN, you know, she was very apologetic about this, and she said, "Look, I'm going to make it up to you." And she put the 8-Bit Adventures 2 trailer on the front page of IGN. She put it on their YouTube channel. She put it on all their social media. And so, of course, like, you know, on YouTube, we ended up getting like over 100,000 views and, you know, all this sort of thing. And there were all these comments coming in, and, you know, of people discovering the game, but really interested. It was just a really exciting and wonderful time where, you know, a lot of new people sort of came into the community and got interested in the game.
Gee, I can only imagine the rush.
Very exciting.
Because everybody's glued to their televisions or phones or whatever at that time, especially. So people are looking for the next best thing to look forward to, I suppose, or get their hands on. And that would have been a hell of a thing for you guys. And
I made the, like, my thing is always I try and respond to everyone.
Yes.
So I went through all the IGN video and I responded to every single comment. But then IGN's automatic bot detection deleted every single thing. So I had to do it all again.
Yeah. Oh man. I love that. And the thing that I really like, and this is something that I've only just discovered here, getting to know you over the last hour now, it's like you can really see how passionate you are about what you do. And like,
thanks,
obviously in this conversation, I'm only scratching the surface. Like, you know, it's just how it is for podcasty stuff. But I have a lot of admiration for people who take creative stuff seriously, because I know how hard it can be. I don't know how hard it can be for developing a game, for example. But I mean, you've gone through it now. You've released several successful titles. On Steam, you also have, and this is something I unfortunately don't know about, it's Tales Across Time. So this is another story-driven RPG. This came out in like just after your 8-Bit Adventures remaster.
About a year. About a year.
And this was...
Yeah, so this was just kind of a palate cleanser, I guess you'd say. So basically, while art assets were being created for 8-Bit Adventures 2, after sort of the initial planning was done, I made a game out of, you know, essentially open source assets.
Yeah.
And just basically tried to make a short story RPG. So an RPG that's sort of about, you know, 5 hours. Just something a bit different, just because obviously going from, you know, 8-Bit Adventures 1 to 8-Bit Adventures 2, you know, obviously you're getting a lot of the same, you're doing the same sort of world and some of the same characters and things like that. So it was just good to sort of have a palette cleanser and experiment with some different ideas. And so, you know, I'd always wanted to try sort of doing a one-on-one battle system in a turn-based RPG. That's what I did with Tales Across Time. And, you know, just trying out some different ideas like that, some of which then sort of made their way into 8-Bit Adventures 2.
Yeah. So, I mean, we could cover so much more ground, but I'm also aware of time. With everything you've learned from 8-Bit Adventures 2, which again, if you're listening, please go buy this game, get it at full price if you can, because it does make a difference.
Everything does help.
It does make a difference.
It does go into more development.
Yeah,
like that is the thing I would definitely say to everyone.
Yeah,
like if you're buying an indie game, the money is probably going into the next indie game.
Yep, sure is. So speaking of what's next, I know you can't tell me, but how can I ask without asking it?
They're all RPGs.
They're all RPGs. Are they similar scale? Are you looking to scale down? Are you looking to scale up? I mean,
that is the perfect question. I am looking to scale down because I want to essentially make more games more regularly.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, I never want to do a 7-year development cycle again if I can help it.
I can't imagine.
You know, two years is, I think, the sweet spot, right? I think that is the point where it's like an indie developer with a small, passionate audience can sort of make enough money to keep making games and sort of keep yourself afloat.
Yeah.
So that's really what I am trying to think about going forward. Before that, I also do have free DLC for 8-Bit Adventures 2 coming.
Oh, great. Cool.
So that is in production. So the idea of that is it's sort of, you know, post-game content that's going to sort of up the challenge a bit.
Yep.
And be like designed for max level and sort of all the best gear and you know, trying to sort of, you know, make use of that stuff because, you know, as 8-Bit Adventures 2 and most RPGs are guilty of, you know, you don't always really get to use the best gear in the, yep. in the game.
You usually get the best sword right before you hit the final boss, and that's it.
Exactly. but it will also be story-driven, so it's going to have some more, you know, narrative meat on the bone as well.
Yeah.
And then we've also got consoles. That's reaching a crescendo, I think. I'm currently testing
nice.
Every single console. So it's been really nice to, yeah. you know, have that experience and reach that point.
There's so much I could ask you again, but I'm just aware of time. Like, I'm just having questions of like dev
anything,
kits. Like, how do you test for like Steam? I suppose is a little bit more accessible to get on.
It is like very much. Yeah,
I don't want to say that anybody can get on Steam, but anybody can get stuff on Steam to a certain extent.
You really can now. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If you pay the $100 fee, you can feasibly put anything up depending on Steam's moderation.
Sure. Yeah. How do you get in with like trying to release something in the eShop? Because I know that from what I've been told, it's a little bit more difficult and they're a little bit more strict with getting stuff on there.
Well, it's...
Or am I wrong?
I've got to be careful of what I can say.
Please, that's...
Obviously, you're under...
I understand that.
NDAs, but really all you need to do is reach out to Nintendo.
Okay.
So you create a Nintendo developer account. It's that's like a public page.
Yep.
So you just search Nintendo developer and then you create an account there, and then basically just have to write to them and say, look, I'm working on this game. Here's some information about it. Here's what I want to do on Nintendo Switch and all that sort of thing. And then they sort of decide whether they allow you on the platform.
Okay.
So it's
fairly straightforward, but...
It's straightforward. It just it's a lot more long winded. There's a lot more involved.
Okay.
Steam is very, very streamlined compared to
sure.
consoles. Consoles take a lot of work. Like it was probably 2 months just setting up Nintendo, PlayStation, Xbox, sort of profiles more or less. There's a lot of work involved in that.
And it's all similar for like PlayStation and Xbox stuff as well, more or less.
They're all different.
Okay.
They're all very different. To be honest,
interesting.
If you're a developer that wants to put your game on consoles, you know, definitely aim for that, but just set aside quite a bit of time to prepare for that as early as possible, I'd say.
Yeah, fair enough. That makes sense. And yeah, I totally respect you telling me without telling me, because I know
I would love to tell you everything.
I'm sure, I understand that. I suppose for last question here, just because we're getting close to the hour mark, and super, super appreciative of your time today.
It's a pleasure. Anytime.
I like the fact that you've just done this. I don't want to say you've done it all yourself, but it is very homegrown. There's a lot of your DNA in what you do, and as a result, you've learned a lot because you've had those failures. You've had those hurtful reviews, you know, you've had all that stuff and you've grown from it. What advice, and this is a very broad question, what advice would you give to somebody who's listening to this thinking, I would like to get into game development, or what do I do next? Because I have an interest in this. How do I take this forward? And to double up on that, what kind of tools are available for those people who want to take the next step?
Good question. Okay, so what I would say is think about what your strengths are and look for a tool which works with those strengths. So, you know, I am terrible at programming. I'm not a mathematician. I'm a sort of designer. I'm a conceptualizer. I'm a writer. That's sort of my field. And so that's why I end up going with RPG Maker MV for 8-Bit Adventures 2. Even though that seems really limiting on the surface, it's got a really ideal interface for someone like me, because you can, it all follows a very simple sort of logic, I guess you would say. You know, there's nothing that sort of someone like me can't understand because of a limited grasp of programming. But at the same time, it's also an engine that a programmer, if you hire one, can then greatly expand upon the functionality of that engine and do all sorts of things with it, which is what we did. We used RPG Maker MV, but we also had 130 plugins.
Oh yeah,
added on to the engine to try and make everything that we needed work. So I think that's one thing, is like look for a tool that fits what you're good at. Like, if you are really good at, you know, maths and programming and that type of thing, look for a tool which, you know, sort of puts that element maybe front and center and is maybe less visual. You know, but if you're a, you know, if you're an artist, try and look for something that, you know, is more visual by contrast. And, you know, it really is the usual names. It is, I mean, despite some of the reputation stuff now, you know, it is Unity. You know, Unreal Engine 5 is really good, depending on what you want to make. You can make anything in Unreal Engine 5. I know someone who's making, like, a Game Boy Zelda-style game in Unreal Engine 5, but I know it's also been an effort to try and sort of, you know, make the engine do that. And certainly thinking of genre as well as your own strengths, you know, what you want to make, because obviously it's going to be much harder to make your 3D Dark Souls style game in RPG Maker compared to Unreal Engine 5.
Sure.
So thinking about that type of thing is important, but in general, the advice that I give to everyone that asks is please start small.
No 7 years dev cycles.
we all sort of have these ideas for games. Like, no matter who you are, I think we all have ideas for games that we think would be really cool. You know, certainly I'm not saying, like, don't try and go for your dream game or anything like that first off, but try and start as small as possible. Try and make a game that you can finish, and try and make a game that is going to sort of teach you things without taking over your life. I think that's really important when starting out. And it also will teach you scale, because if you start small, even though the game sounds like it's going to be small, it will not actually be small to make. And that'll teach you the lesson that I had to learn on 8-Bit Adventures 2, which is just about, like, the, you know, what you think is going to be small is not small. So it gives you a sense of scale going forward. And that sense of scale is going to really help you to plan out any games in future. That's what I tell everyone.
That's some really great and important, most importantly, honest advice. Not letting anybody, like, chase your dreams, but you gotta remember that it's kind of a staircase. You can't just run up the top right away and expect results. Gotta start small.
You can't make Final Fantasy VII Rebirth for your first game, you know, like,
everybody who's watching or listening, I'll leave links down below in YouTube description or on Spotify as well for people listening. You can find Joshua at Critical Games AU. You can search 8-Bit Adventures on Steam, and then you probably don't have a release date for consoles and stuff, but if you follow along on Twitter, I'm sure you'll be able to update everybody who follows.
I just posted screenshots of Switch.
Yeah.
Just for anyone that's interested.
Yes, yeah. I did see that. Please go buy these games, because if you want to actually support a smaller dev team, smaller developer, buying these games on Steam does make a difference. And if you want to see more from that team behind 8-Bit Adventures 2, you got to support it. And is there anywhere else we can find you other than Twitter at the moment?
I mean, technically, I'm on TikTok, I'm on Instagram. It's just they haven't really worked out that well for me.
Yeah.
So social media landscape has kind of changed, so I'm not really even sure what to do with it. But that's probably something to think about for for maybe the next game and see see where things are at. But thank you very much for saying all that, because it really. It sincerely does make a difference. Like, you know, every single sale is very, very meaningful.
Yep, that's great. And I'm happy to support people with smaller independent creators, because I really believe in that. Whether you get to the square size or whatever, it doesn't matter, because thematically you can be making games that have that same emotional connection, like you said, that a game like a Final Fantasy can to the individual. It doesn't matter anymore. You know, and it's stuff like this that I want to break down the barriers of. I want to be able to have this conversation with you, so that way people can listen in and be like, just a normal guy, and he's making sacrifices in his normal life to make this game that I can go play. That's really great, and I really have a lot of respect in that, and it's been so great to talk to you today.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, because, yeah, that is, I think, the type of thing that people don't think about, is that, yeah, games do take a lot to create. And more than I ever realized, so...
I'm very sure.
If you're watching here on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe. Or if you're listening on Apple and Spotify, don't forget to rate and follow if you can. All relevant links will be in the show notes or the description. We'll see you again on the next one. Thank you for watching and thank you for listening. Ta-da.